words himself. So I'd like to introduce the speaker for today, His Holiness Devamrita Swami. He is an author and researcher specializing in history and knowledge of ancient India. Born in New York City, he began his immersion in India upon graduating from Yale University, where one of the topmost presidents of the United States of America graduated from in 1972. He practically visits India annually, and he is an ordained sannyasi and a monk, and he is a disciple of His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And he is basically based in Australia and New Zealand, where he develops communities and very popular amongst youngsters, and also has organized many farm communities, very revolutionizing farm communities, and he has been also very popular amongst the youth. So today's presentation is going to be on a part of this book which forms the foundation of the premise of this presentation, and probably he will take us to the depths that probably we may not have been able to decipher and discover. So I'd like to welcome amongst ourselves, and please welcome His Holiness Devamrita Swami with a big round of applause.
I'm very happy to be here with you again, just to show my appreciation of speaking at this institution. I was here maybe 2 years ago, but just to show my factual appreciation, I got off the plane in the middle of the night last night, and by the time I got to sleep it was midnight this morning, and then I came here to speak. I flew in all the way from Australia, but even though I came in so late from Australia, or this morning that is, I heard about the presentations going on here, and I decided I would make a special effort to be with you. When we talk about the real wealth of India, we are talking about knowledge, wisdom. Genuine knowledge and wisdom is so much missing in the world today. In fact, we need to try to understand how genuine knowledge and wisdom has been pushed aside and even purposely covered. A blanket has been put on it so that people will work very hard and consume, purchase very vigorously. If you take away all real knowledge, and if you take away all real wisdom, then people can participate in a culture of simply working hard and purchasing. When I'm speaking at universities in other parts of the world, I give them a mantra. India is famous for mantras. Many of you are aware of the Hare Krishna mantra, which has now captured the whole world. But in the Western consumerist societies, they do have their own mantra, and they are very eager that India takes to this mantra from the West. That mantra is work, buy, consume, die. That is the mantra that you're supposed to all embrace and be very dutiful about it. Let's look at the world situation. The problems of the world today can be traced to a lack of self-understanding and a lack of cosmic understanding. The spiritual culture of India deals directly with self-identity and our role in the cosmos, as well as beyond the cosmos. When human beings lack that knowledge, that wisdom, they destroy themselves and destroy the world. And that is what you're seeing going on today. People do not know what is real wealth. They don't know what is real treasure. So let's look at some of the questions that are on the mind of every thinking person. But please understand that the way society is functioning today, it's very difficult to be a thinking person. There are four great myths that are affecting your life and the world situation. Myth number one is that money brings happiness. Myth number two is that technology brings prosperity. Myth number three is that weapons bring security. And myth number four is that the earth provides unlimited resources. So these four basic myths prevent people from understanding their real situation. In fact, how valuable is it? How important is it for us to understand our real situation? We live in a kind of society that makes knowledge of enlightenment, knowledge of the self, knowledge of the Supreme Self, very unimportant and trivial. Meanwhile, the problems of the world simply increase. Let us look at a statement from the ancient Vedic texts. The information is given using the example of birds and a tree. There are two birds on the tree. One is the eating bird, the other is the observing bird. This example from the ancient Vedic texts, particularly the Upanishads, is meant to teach you what is going on in terms of your existence. The tree is comparable to your body. And the two birds are comparable to the finite consciousness and the infinite consciousness. So, on the tree of your body reside you, the finite, limited consciousness, and also the supreme consciousness, the unlimited consciousness. Together, those two personalities are there. That's what constitutes your existence. So this example of the two birds on the tree has been a perennial, constant part of India's spiritual culture. In other words, I'm different from the body. I'm the limited bird, and also along with me is the unlimited bird. What are these two birds doing? What are these two consciousnesses doing? One is the eating bird trying to exploit this world. The other is the observing bird. The supreme consciousness is watching whatever the limited consciousness does. Our growth-mad economies had their own version of this verse from the ancient Vedic texts. They teach you, there are two birds on the tree of the body. One bird is called more, and the other bird is called better. These two birds are always on the same tree. That means if you have more, you have better and you are better. But when we look at the situation today, scientifically, we find a problem. It seems that although more and better seem to reside on the same tree, somehow or other, better has flown off to another tree. So although you have more, the bird called more, the bird called better has gone elsewhere. Please think about that. The standard response of behavior in our modern societies has always been that if one of something is good, two is better. If two are good, four, five, six, seven, ten is better. So this is what drives everyone in today's quantitative society. I have to have more and more because then things will be better and better. So now we are approaching a situation in India in which I can use examples that I would normally only use in North America and Europe. If one beer is good, two beers are better. If two beers are better, 10 beers are great. If one girlfriend is good, two are better. Or if two boyfriends are good, four are better. Yeah, this is what's happening now. But what about the reality that the bird named better has flown off to another tree? Everyone is striving for more, more, more. But look around. Where is the better? When I was on the plane from Australia flying here via Bangkok, I saw a front page article in the Sydney newspaper glorifying India because now liquor and whiskey is booming. Every year there has been a 20% increase in alcohol sales. So the Australian newspaper was saying, this is the sign of India's progress. And it pointed out that the old India, the old-fashioned India, where alcohol consumption was looked down upon, that has all gone away now. The Gandhian notions that alcohol consumption is taboo, that has all gone away now. And the newspaper pointed out, only in one state in India, Gujarat, are there still laws against alcohol. And it pointed out that we all know the result of what happens when there are laws against alcohol. There'll simply be black market sales. There'll simply be organized crime. In other words, the best thing to do is never to prohibit alcohol sales. So, the news article was alerting all Western entrepreneurs, capitalists, the biggest economic opportunity in the world is the India alcohol consumption market. Such an untapped potential. 1 billion people who have not fully immersed in the glories of alcohol. Now, I know this is an engineering school, but engineering is closely related to marketing these days. The marketing people figure out, how can we create artificial needs? And then they say to the engineers, create something that will fulfill artificial needs. So the engineers are not simply working for charity. The engineers, they want money. And the money is driven by marketing, creating artificial needs in people. And then the engineers are supposed to create consumer goods that fulfill those artificial needs. Is there an alternative to this kind of lifestyle in which the best of human intelligence is being used to fulfill artificial needs? We have to think about that. Marketing people are always on the lookout for how to create artificial desires and how to fulfill these artificial desires. So you can understand, they're looking at India, and it looks like such a juicy prospect. 1 billion people, and they're just discovering consumerism. They're discovering the superior way of life, which has devastated other parts of the world. I was listening to the president of Coca-Cola, just to give you an idea of this mentality. The unenlightened mind. The president of Coca-Cola was talking about Indonesia. Sometimes it's easier to talk about another country because we're not so attached to the other country as we are to our homeland. So he was speaking about Indonesia, and this gives you an idea of a particular mentality. We want to focus on that mentality this morning. He looked at Indonesia and said, do you understand what's going on in Indonesia? There are, how many, what's the population of Indonesia? 200 million? Or anyone know? About 200 million people. And 50% of the population is under the age of 25. And the country's on the equator. It's always hot there. And there's a Muslim ban on alcohol. So the president of Coca-Cola was saying, when I think of all these reasons, when I think of Indonesia, I know what heaven is. They'll have to buy Coca-Cola. So now, just imagine when that mentality is applied to India. Very low alcohol consumption. Desire held back by religious taboos and social taboos. Take away those religious taboos, take away those social taboos, and you have a huge market. In other words, everything is about growth, growth, growth of the consumer society. And that is supposed to bring prosperity. The intellectual leaders of the West are already starting to realize they've made a huge mistake. They're dealing with the question, should humans shift from a current growth-focused society to a new definition of progress? And as engineers who devise the ways and means for progress, you should be thinking, do we need a new definition of progress? Maybe we're going up the wrong tree. The current economic norms are all about growth, growth, growth. The more growth there is for the economy, the better things will be for everyone. But we can analyze and see that is not true. Can the earth, which is limited, can it be a place for unlimited aspirations and desires? So, first of all, as we said, the marketing people create artificial desires and inflame those artificial desires. Then the engineers come along and devise the products to fulfill the artificial desires. and the retail people sell it all. Once I was on the airplane going from London to New York, and there were some business executives from Delhi. They were on the plane also. And they were describing, what does India need to get ahead? We need a chemical industry like Germany. We need a manufacturing sector like Japan. And we need to retail like the Americans. Then everything will be perfect. Now you may say, what's wrong with that? If all those things go on, leading chemical industry, leading manufacturing industry, leading retailing industry, there'll be jobs for everyone, and everyone will be peaceful and satisfied. But think, how can you separate the global economy from nature, the global ecology? It can't happen. You are engineers. You're not operating in a vacuum. You're operating within nature. So on the one hand, people are being agitated to have unlimited aspirations, unlimited desires. But can the earth fulfill those unlimited desires? Does the earth have the resources to fuel unlimited desires? And does the earth have the ability to accommodate all the waste that comes from producing to fulfill unlimited desires? In both cases, the answer is no. Therefore, we need to look to a different definition of progress. And why can't engineers lead the way in doing that? Engineers are supposed to be the most brilliant people for devising a better way to get from point A to point B. So why can't engineers be entrusted with the task of devising a new vision of human progress? So what is wrong with the growth-driven path? It's not environmentally viable. It won't work. And the amazing thing is, it doesn't even work economically. So it's not that simply the environmental do-gooders, the green people, they have to be satisfied, because the unlimited growth consciousness is destructive to the earth. What's obvious now is that the unlimited growth consciousness is not even making sense economically. The havoc caused by environmental destruction is costing so much. Nature is inflicting heavy reactions upon the human race. What I'm speaking about is cutting-edge knowledge. I admit that the mainstream has not fully embraced these points yet, even though the verdict is knocking on the door. There's something in human beings that makes them want to avoid reality. One famous economist responsible for so much of capitalistic thought, he's so revered in the current economic understanding, John Maynard Keynes, he said a very interesting point about whether mainstream scientists and economists, will they ever see what's going on? He said, we are capable of turning off even the sun and the stars because they do not pay dividends. This is how greedy we are. What's the use of the sun? What's the use of the moon or the stars? They're not paying dividends. Everything has to lead to more, more, more. This situation shows a very deep lack of wisdom, integrity, genuineness. Let's look at your teenage years. I know you're not doctors here, right? They don't teach medical science here. All right. But still, you should know something about your own body and what it means to be a teenager. And then you can understand the world situation better and how the spiritual knowledge associated with India can actually solve the problems. When you're a teenager, let's look at the men. We'll talk about the men. By the time you're 15, a hormone, a chemical hormone called testosterone, increases tenfold. That's why suddenly you start looking at the other gender and making plans. It's chemical victimization. You're surrendering to the chemicals, the hormones in your body. Tenfold increase in testosterone. Your voice gets deep, your hair on your chest starts to grow. And you make active plans how to pursue the opposite sex. We can compare human society when it's possessed with lust for consumption, production, consumption, production, consumption. We can compare that to a hormone-driven teenager. Where are the girls? Where are the girls? Let me find them in the classroom. Let me find them on the internet. Let me find them somewhere. Where are the girls? So, human society is like that about production and consumption. More, more. Where is more? Where is more? Will human society ever reach adulthood? Adulthood is supposed to mean maturity. Maturity for human society means that it stops becoming so crazy about growth and starts to look at the quality of life. Developing a quality life. Maintaining a quality life. A quality life means one based upon knowledge, wisdom, justice, integrity. Of course, in order to have real knowledge, wisdom, justice, and integrity, we need to have precise understanding of what is the self and what is the supreme self. Now, if we interfere with our development as adults, if we never check, if we never stop this crazy more, 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 we're like teenagers that never grow up. And that's why you see things like resource wars, massive die-offs, overpopulation, obesity. All these things are because human society has, its growth has become arrested in the teenage phase. No wisdom, no knowledge. Now you may say, look, we're just engineers. It's not our job to worry about wisdom and knowledge. We do applied science here. It's not our job to figure out what is good for society and what is not good for society. We simply devise the best means of production. But I think that many of you in this room are ready to go deeper and understand that every human being has the responsibility to deal with the deep issues of life. Or maybe, do we have in the room any techno-optimists? How does a techno-optimist see the world, even amidst the problems today? The techno-optimist sees the world history as an endless series of innovations, always redefining that basket we call resources. What's an example they give? I want to make sure you hear the other side. The techno-optimists say, look, for most of human history, what was coal? Just a black rock. Up until recently, what was silicon? Just beach sand. So you see, the engineers can just turn pebbles into gold. Engineers can point out, this is not a black rock. This is coal. Burn it. This is not beach sand. This is silicon. Use it for chips and solar panels. Once again, though, there's a problem. There is a limitation to the resources of this world. So now you have human beings basically who are flesh-covered machines for combusting coal, oil, and natural gas. That's the meaning of life. Flesh-covered machines for combusting coal, natural gas, and oil. That's the prime characteristic of a human being today. And that's what progress is supposed to mean. The spiritual wealth of India points to a different kind of human being. One who understands what is the self, what is the supreme self, what is consciousness. It's this kind of wise person that we want to encourage developing. How can we actually have prosperity? How can we actually have world peace and justice if there is no program for individual development? If everyone is taught simply how to be greedy, how to buy more and buy more, produce more, produce more. First of all, it doesn't make any material sense. The world can't handle it. And secondly, the human beings are destroying themselves. What will happen by the year 2050, the middle of this century, when supposedly there are going to be 9 billion people on the earth? That means by the middle of this century, 2 Chinas will be added to the world population. Where are the engineers that are ready to handle that? But this is the reality. It doesn't add up. Something's got to give. So unless we can train up human beings with higher qualities, higher knowledge, with wisdom, who know how to control their mind and senses, what will be the future of the world? Often when I'm speaking at universities around the world, I ask students, I know it's probably different here, but I ask them, when you applied for your status as student in your university, on the application, whether it was written or an online application, how many of you saw the question, can you control your mind and senses? Maybe this university is different here, but... Control my mind and senses. What difference does that make? How many of you saw the question on your application? Do you know who you are? Do I know who I am? What's that got to do with the world? Do I know who I am? That's not related to human progress. So this is the myth that is covering human society these days. So please remember, the global techno-economy is part of a global ecosystem. We can't separate one thing from the other. Why is it that people have difficulty seeing this connection? It's because of the greed that is spread throughout society. Never mind what the effect is on the present or the future. I have to get for me. Let others worry about the world. I'm entitled to get my share. This mentality shows a complete lack of self-knowledge. The first step when we want to escape from so much illusion, so much hypocrisy, the first step is to understand what is the self, what is the supreme self. That means you're dealing with consciousness. When we talk about the Atma, that unit of consciousness described in the Vedas as the self, then we can begin to understand what is human progress. Because human beings have a spiritual self, consciousness indicates the spiritual self. Therefore, we need to adopt precise measures for uplifting our consciousness so that we can connect with the Supreme Consciousness. Now, as I often explain at IIT and places like that, there is not one technological device in the world today that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. But who here will deny that they have consciousness? You are engineers. There's not one engineering device that can directly detect consciousness, but would you say you're not conscious? All of you will say you're conscious, even though there's no technological means to directly detect consciousness. So where do we go to learn this science of consciousness? That science of consciousness and the Supreme Consciousness, that is India's greatest gift to the world. And that is the only thing that can stop this mad and greedy quest for unlimited economic growth. I'll give you a scientific example to show you the mysteries of consciousness that we're not being taught. Just recently, in a topmost scientific journal, information was given about consciousness at the time of death. You know, the question has always been there. Does consciousness survive death? In the USA, it has been calculated that at least 3% of the population has had near-death experiences while they were on the operating table and they were reported to be clinically dead. Later, they supposedly came back to life and could tell the doctor exactly what was happening in the operating room, even though the electronic machines for measuring brain electrical activity were flatlined. Still, the person was able to say, you did this, you did that, you did that, and the doctors are astonished by this. Well, recently, there have been some tests showing that, okay, I know you're not medical students, but I'll describe it in a technological way. There are machines for measuring brain electrical activity to help anesthesists determine how much anesthesia to give you during operation. So, there's a scale of 0 to 100. A fully awake person is more or less at the 100 level. In order for you to be operated on, you need anesthesia that will put you between the 40 and the 60 level. When you go below 40, you're on your way to death. And when you get down to 20 and then down to 0, that's it. All right. So, these sophisticated electronic devices made by medical engineers, maybe some of you will become medical engineers. So these devices show that when someone is put off the life support mechanisms, their brain activity goes from 40, because they're under anesthesia, down to 0. But then for 60 or 90 seconds, it pops back up to 80. And then after 60 or 90 seconds at the 80 level, it plummets again to 0. So this is totally astonishing, scientists. How do you go down near zero and even to zero, you're clinically dead, and then for 60 or 90 seconds, you're up to 80, which is almost fully awake? What's going on? Is there some conscious entity that is leaving the body? Those who study the spiritual science of India have no doubts what's going on. But I just wanted to give you some laboratory insight into mysteries of the self that are actually meant for study from the spiritual point of view. Once we redefine what human progress is, then we can better focus on these mysteries of the self and the supreme self. But we have to get out of our heads this madness, this greedy madness that's destroying the world. Where do you see in the world the knowledge and the culture for arresting this horrible decline? No one has it. Yet, if we look at the ancient spiritual knowledge of India, we find all the spiritual resources necessary for transforming the path of human civilization from destructive to constructive. So that is one motivation why I wrote the book that I did. I'm happy to hear that one of the courses here taught by my cohorts is based on that book. And I'm very happy that so many of you take this potential of spiritual knowledge so seriously. It's the real science. People have to know what is their identity beyond being a producer and consumer. The world can't handle unlimited consumption, unlimited production anymore. We need a new vision for a human life. Thank you very much.
There are so many words and phrases that need to be inscribed in our hearts and not in our minds. We really deeply thank His Holiness Devamay Swami Maharaj for speaking so concisely and precisely. And so much that we have a vision to work for. And therefore, we need to continuously apply these principles, understand these principles, and react in a way that is beneficial and constructive for the human progress. Engineering a vision for a new human progressive society should become the aim of us engineers here. So I thank again. I know we are all spellbound. We want more time. We will leave our option to you. Those who would like to leave for your classes can leave and take your snacks out there. But those who want to ask questions pertaining specific insights and directives, there is more to be revealed here. It was just the tip of the iceberg. And on the way, you can pick up a copy of this book. This is going to add more dimensions to your vision, because what he spoke was just a brief summary of what he has written in his books. So I'll appeal for questions if some have, or else you can leave for classes. But he's also personally available to interact after the session. Thank you so much.